And thanks, Carrie, for leading us in meditation. And my thanks to the entire Wet Mountain Sangha community for supporting this, making this possible, not just tonight, but this practice that is woven into the community of Pueblo because of your steady presence and everything here. So many thanks. And my welcome and thanks to everyone who took the time to be here tonight to see what this is going to be about, including me. So I wanted to start by just saying a little bit about our particular lineage, our tradition. As I see it, as it really folds into the main area of the evening as well. But we are officially the open source Koan Zen tradition. And so the Koan bit we'll get to in a little bit. And Zen, better left unsaid. But the open source, I wanted to talk a little bit about what that is and what that means to me. Because it's interesting with the stuff we have in the world already called open source. You might see, oh, there are similarities here, but there's also probably quite big divergences as well. But one thing is, it's not just completely everything's open and groovy and it's fine and you just come here and practice whatever you practice. Because as was mentioned, we come from a very particular tradition, the Koan Zen tradition. And so it's got its own style, its own way of approaching things. So that's very particular. So the open source aspect of things to me means like the sources of wisdom, the sources of awakening, of enlightenment, or the source itself of all of it, is open in the world itself. It's not contained in any one tradition. It's like we don't have the exclusive rights to awakening in our tradition, or in Zen, or in Buddhism. It's in every tradition, there's that source of awakening, of freedom. And it doesn't even mean traditions that are religious in nature. It could be the traditions of free thinkers, atheists, poets, musicians, gardeners. Whatever you do, yeah? It's open. Everything is an opening source to freedom, to awakening in life. And so our particular tradition is a particular way of bringing forth that freedom, which, if it makes sense to you, helps you find your freedom, then great, practice it. If it does part way and there's something else you need to bring in from somewhere else, great, it's open, you can do that. You need to combine what you can in your life or find what you can in your life that helps you connect with your inherent freedom. So we have a lot of stories about things, yeah? About this tradition is better than that one, and we spend a lot of time as humans trying to figure out which is the right thing and all that, when I think it's not about trying to figure out which is the one that's right for everybody. It's about which one speaks my particular language and helps me connect with what I already inherently have. Yeah? So I was thinking, like somebody who really loves combs and tries to make a tradition out of, you've got to have a comb. Having a comb is the greatest thing. You've got to use it. And they come to me and say, you really need a comb. I'll say, I don't have a use for it. That doesn't speak my language. And I think it'd be the same thing with any kind of tradition. Anybody trying to say, this is the way, it's like, well, it may be the way for you, but I need to find the way for me. And fortunately, it's wide open. And it's just a matter of finding it and connecting with it. And I think we can now take that philosophy, that approach, and move it right into our very lives and into the territory of the evening, which is to say your life itself is an open source of wisdom, of awakening. All the facets of your life is flowing with awakening. It's the source. It's not somewhere else. It's in the very life that you're living, about which we tend to have lots of stories, about why it isn't, and what it needs to look like, and what it should be, yeah? But I think it could be the same thing. It's like, well, that particular way of being doesn't quite work for me, but because it doesn't work, it helps me find out what does work. So it's kind of that opposite effect. Because it doesn't work, it helps me find my way, right? But I don't think it's really much about having to discard anything about your ordinary daily life to find awakening. It's more about looking deeply into your life and understanding it for what it is and seeing what it is and seeing how your freedom is constantly shining forth through a myriad colors, myriad expressions, yeah. So I wanted tonight to look at those stories that we tend to tell ourselves and bring in, ironically enough, a story about it, an ancient story. It comes from the beginnings of the Koan tradition 1300 to 1400 years ago in China. So I like that in two respects. In one, it's kind of saying at the beginning of the tradition, here was the approach. But it's also saying 1400 years ago and way before then, we humans were telling stories about our lives and having questions about our lives that are pretty much the same questions we're having today. And so it's not that there was something happening back then that we have to try to figure out what to do. It's to realize, oh, they're living lives, different times, different cultures, but very much like the ones we live. And they have questions. They had questions. They have. Maybe they still have them, because we are them, yeah, the ancestors. They had the same questions that I have. Maybe they're saying them in a different way, but at its essence, these are the things I'm looking for too. So it's kind of comforting, I think, to know that we're not the first ones trying to figure this out. We're not the first ones struggling with the life we have or reaching for a freedom that we think is beyond it. It's been going on for quite a while. So I'll just bring in the questions from a student came to the teacher, his name was Shito, one of the two main teachers at the beginning of the Koan tradition. So I'm just going to bring in the questions and look at them for a little bit. And when I do so, notice, you know, maybe the wording of the question isn't quite the wording that you would use, but notice what would be your question along the same vein. And I'll look into that a little bit myself along the way. The person comes and says, "How can I be free?" And this person also asks, "How can I purify and cleanse myself of negativity and darkness? Those things that get me in trouble." Yeah. And then again asks, "How can I get beyond the pain and difficulty of this life once and for all and just, you know, be through with struggling?" Yeah. So does this resonate some? Does this kind of on your mind sometimes? In your heart mind, as we say? Again, think about how would you ask that question, right? In order to ask these questions, I see that I would have to have a story about what my life is or isn't. The first one being, I'm not free. And I don't feel it, and I need to know how to do it. So I go to somebody who's a teacher and ask that person, "How can I be free? You seem, maybe you've gotten something there that you can do with it. Maybe you can help me." Then there's, you know, how can I cleanse and purify myself of negativity and darkness, the habits I have, the things that I do that cause pain to myself and others. And, you know, when I call them negativity and darkness, I can kind of feel them sticking to me and the icky stuff. How can I just cleanse myself of that and be rid of it, yeah? Those two, probably all three questions, connected, a different way of maybe asking the same question. And then, you know, how can I get beyond the pains and difficulty of this life that I'm living, once and for all? Is there a way that I can finally, you know how to do it right? A way that I can approach and live it so that I'm not dealing with all the stuff I'm having to deal with all the time that just seems one step forward, two steps back, 10 steps back, whatever it is. I'm walking along fine, then I fall into a hole, all that kind of stuff. How can I get beyond that kind of stuff and stop living that way, yeah? So for me, that's what that is at the heart of those questions. I got this story about my life is troublesome. I grow weary leading it, and I've heard about other lives and other ways of living, and I'm certainly not living them, so how can I find them? How can I get there? So now I'll say the questions again and then give the response that the teacher gave, responses that the teacher gave, and then I'll explore them a little bit. So, person comes to the teacher and says, how can I be free? The teacher says, who has ever put you in chains and bound you? So maybe bounces back from that, like, huh. Okay, let me try again. Well, how can I purify my negativity and darkness, that icky stuff in my life? How can I purify and cleanse that? Teacher responds, who has ever contaminated you with such things? And then the last, how can I get beyond the pain and difficulty of this life once and for all? Teacher responds, who has ever limited you to this life and its experiences? Nice, I think. So before I go into the specifics, I want to talk a little bit about koans. You may have heard about them before. If you're new to them, maybe you've heard about them somewhere else, or even you've heard about them if you're practicing here. But just one aspect of them that I want to bring in, which I think is an important, a central thing about them, is sometimes there's this thing that koans are these riddles and unsolvable, baffling statements that are meant to thwart your rational mind and cause it to break, you know, to get rid of that thing. And that, essentially, there's a story there that the rational mind is a problem. And koans are meant to thwart it and get rid of it. It's more that they're dislodging the rational mind, the discursive mind, from the place it's set up, camp, for quite some time. You know, usually that's the case. You know, it's not saying get out of here, it's saying you are a wide array of a being. You are much more than that part of yourself, that rational, discursive thinking self. But in our lives, that self, that way of being, has value and does a lot of things for us. It helps us pay the bills and get their garbage to the curb and know what groceries to buy, all that kind of thing. But because we use it a lot, it tends to take over and figure out, oh, I'm in charge here. And yeah, there's these other things going on, but I'm the main dude. I'm the main part of you that's important. To varying degrees. You know, maybe 10 steps out in front of the others, maybe a mile. Who knows? That's for each of us to look and know for ourselves. What koans do is kind of dislodge that particular way of being from its particular place and return it to the fold of who we are, which includes much more than that part of ourselves. So we're not getting rid of it. We're saying, you know, go back in line with everything else. And other things have an ability to respond and deal with life. There's other ways of doing it. And how about we do it together? We come forward, take turns. What's the best response? Best way of responding? Let that aspect of ourselves be just as present as any other. Yeah? So that being said, it's really easy when you hear that story I've said, or any kind of koan story, to have that rational, discursive mind kick in right away. It's the one that wants to figure out, okay, what's the point here? What's the message? What's the moral? And how can we get the message here and then run with it? Yeah? There is no moral in koans. There's nothing. They're empty. There's nothing at all within them. There's no point hidden within the koan itself that you have to get. It only exists when you meet it. So from the beginning, the rational mind doesn't even know. Yeah, there's nothing there. But it can certainly see something there. And so I think when I look at my mind coming forward in that way with these responses, with the first one, hearing, who has ever put you in chains and bound you? I think, oh, the message is I'm already free. And that's nice. Nothing wrong with that message. So that's why we're not saying get rid of that mind. That's a good message to connect with, yeah? But if we pick it up and run with it, we carry around this story of I'm already free, I'm already free. Then we're replacing a story with the story. The same mind that created the story that I'm not free because of this and that and that, now is carrying around a new story that, oh, I am free. And that can only take us so far, I think. Replacing a story with a story is kind of staying in the exact same place. It's just prettier. The scenery's better. Yeah. And so the invitation really throughout this is to how to notice the story but not to live by it. I'll get more. I'll tell you a story about that later. And it can be helpful to have that, like I said, connect with that. I'm already free. And, you know, drop it into our lives when we're feeling those difficulties. But I don't think it can be the only thing we can rely upon. It's like saying affirmations or something like that. Those can be good, but sometimes if we do that as a regular practice really deeply, they almost become a shield to keep us from really experiencing our lives because we're living in the affirmation of what it should be and how, you know, the feel-good part of it. But we're not really connecting with what's behind that. So in each of these responses, a story can be made. So the next one, the story is, oh, I'm pure and cleansed. Yeah, right. That one's a little harder to believe because I don't feel that way. It's like, oh yeah, I'm inherently free. I've heard other people say that, but somebody saying, who's ever contaminated you with this negativity and darkness? It's harder to make a story out of that because we feel it. It's like, I know it firsthand. I've seen it in action. I've felt it regularly. So that's good that we can't quite make a story. At least I can't quite make a story that I could sell out of that one. Then the last one, who has ever limited you to this life and its experiences? And that's more of a, huh? What do you mean? And that's kind of, what else is, you know, gets me start to do with what I'm doing, looking around like, what possibly could that be about? So there's that moment where I could just say, that doesn't make sense. I don't believe it. And walk away. But I don't. Instead, I return to those responses and really look at what's being asked. Because in one way, it is saying, I'm not free. Yes, you are, in those responses. But if you really look at the question, it's asking, who has ever bound you, put you in chains and bound you? Who has contaminated you? Who has limited you? And the invitation is really to ask that question. Who has done this? How has it happened? You know, to explore the freedom part, it's like, well, picking up books about Zen or any other tradition will talk about a freedom. They put the idea in my head, it's their fault. I didn't know there wasn't such a thing as freedom until they said there was. And then I had a story about what that freedom must look like and why it's not me, all that kind of thing. So it could be that kind of thing. That's who has put me in chains and bound me. Who has contaminated me? Well, I could blame my parents. I could blame society. Blame those who maybe didn't show me how to access what I needed to correctly. I could do all that kind of thing and look at them. And sure, aspects of that are true. Things we learn culturally through our families sometimes become hindrances and barriers. So that might be part of it. And who has limited me to this life? Well, again, society, I think. Here's what you have to do to be successful. Here's what you have to do to live like everybody else. Here's what living a life looks like. Here's what's important. Here's what's not important. All those kind of things. So those things are out there. And so it's interesting to start exploring that question and see, you know, where did I get these ideas from? How did I come to this place of feeling unfree, feeling like I'm a problem, like my life is a problem, like I'm contaminated with bad habits and causing harm and things like that? And how did I get this story about what I need to achieve in my life, and noticing how that story has led me to feel like I'm struggling a lot because I'm not achieving it? So I can see, yeah, I've inherited that a lot from different places. But I keep with that question, well, who has done this? Inevitably, I keep coming back and pointing to this right here, to me. Like, I've done it too. I've made these stories. I've believed the stories. I've created the messes that I'm trying to blame on somebody else sometimes. So I had to kind of recognize, oh, it's me. Maybe I'm the one who has put myself in this position, wrapped the chains and bound myself and dumped the contaminated water of life over myself and really bought into what I thought was supposed to be the life I'm supposed to live, limited myself to this. Maybe it's me. All of the above is a pretty good answer, I think. And again, just as we're not saying one part of ourselves answers the question, it's also not necessary to find the answer. I think it's we continue to explore and notice, moment by moment, day by day, oh, here come the chains again. Look at that, look at that. And to notice the stories we tell ourselves. Notice it happening in action. Maybe tracing things back to the root and realizing, oh, that's where it all came from. And to understand the stories we tell ourselves about why we're not free, why we're not good enough, why life is painful and difficult. So that's really the invitation with these koan stories, and this one in particular, is really look into this and keep looking, keep looking. Don't necessarily try to arrive at an answer, because that's another story. However, there's inherently nothing wrong with the stories either. To go around and say, I need to stop telling myself stories about things, that's another story. Yeah? That's another place to set up camp and get stuck. I'm not making a story about that. I'm not making a story about that. I won't make a story about that. You know, however we want to wield that particular approach. But to recognize making stories is what we do. That's how we get along in our lives. Sometimes we make up unnecessary stories. Sometimes a story begins and it has a useful quality to it and it helps us along. But then we keep telling it over and over, and after it's outlived its use, and we don't notice that it's no longer a living thing that can guide us anymore. Especially stories about ourselves, I think. Who we are, why we're the way we are. And, we can keep telling ourselves those stories and just keep walking in that territory, in that narrative. Or we might be able to realize the stories are just suggestions. They're floating free. They're ways to help us get along, but they're not determining who we are. They're not determining what life is. They are not the end-all and be-all of our existence. They're just another aspect of what we do. Because it's something different to say, I'm contaminated by negativity and darkness, and carry that around as a story, than it is to say, I notice how I cause pain. I notice how I create difficulties, to see it actually happening. And that's just seeing what is actually happening, without having a story of, it's wrong, it needs to go away, it needs to stop. Just noticing, yeah, this is happening. And if we connect with that one aspect of the responses that I'm the person who put the chains on, I'm the person who contaminated myself, then realize, well, maybe I can also undo that. And I think it's simply by not believing in the stories so much. Whether it's a positive story or a negative story. All the stories we have about what freedom might look like, awakening, that kind of thing. Let them float just as lightly. Maybe. But keep looking into, well, what is the freedom right here in the midst of pain and difficulty? So I think one of, to connect with the inherent freedom of being, as I titled this thing, one of the things we do with freedom is we kind of nail it down and have it really look at a particular way and be in a particular place. So by not believing in those stories so much, any of them, especially the ones about freedom, we're just taking the nails out. It's floating and it's falling apart and it's not looking any particular way. And it has the ability to show up in any way, in every way, constantly. So it's always a catch-22 with this kind of stuff. Because then you don't go around going, there's my freedom, there's my freedom, there's my freedom. But if you just go around and notice the stories, notice sometimes you don't have one. Even though you think you do all the time, there's sometimes you are just a person sitting in a room with no history, no particular thing about you connected there. You're just sitting there in a room. That freedom is inherently part of what we are and who we are. And whether we connect with it directly or not, it doesn't mean it's not there. So it's like giving freedom the freedom to show up however it wants to. Which is giving life the permission to be exactly what it is without apology. Without asking it to be different than what it is. Stories we have can be either trying to solidify what's positive and keep it there, or stories about where things need to be and trying to get them to move there. But if we release those particular activities of the stories, there's just life happening. I think one of the places I see this happening is sometimes, it's to go back to the point about the last one. Who has ever limited you to this life and its experiences? It's like on one side, it's like life is happening to me. It's always falling on my head. It's always, you know, that's from the question side. How can I get beyond this stuff? It's always happening to me. And then from the, to replace that with a positive story, it's like, I am life happening. Life is happening for me. You know, we change it that way. In the middle of those, there's just life happening. It doesn't even involve me. There's just life happening. And in the middle of those, I don't mean sandwich between them, in the middle of the conversations of, it's happening to me, it's happening for me. It's right in the middle of all that, life is happening. So what's it like to connect with that? I'm sure you know it. But you can't figure out how you made it happen. Because if you could, that'd be a story. It happens, regardless of our stories. Yeah? And this just brings me around to something that's been on my mind lately with meditation, practice. Zen, for those who don't know, the word just means meditation. It doesn't mean necessarily, it doesn't just mean sitting meditation. It means to live your life as meditation. But doing sitting meditation a lot helps that carry over into life, living it as meditation. But the act of trying to meditate, to establish a practice, I've been noticing for a long time, people, like I'll go speak with a group of people who are new to it, or somebody new will come to the community, and I'll ask, so what's your experience of meditation? And a lot of times they'll say, well, I've tried sitting on my own, but I didn't know how to do it right, and that wasn't good. Or, you know, I went to a couple of communities and I sat in meditation, but I'm not doing well with it yet. Nothing's really happening. I'm not good. I've had a few good meditations, but not all the time. All that, you know, all those kind of stories. Stories. Again. About what meditation is supposed to look like and why they're not experiencing it. And I think, I don't know if it's just at the beginning of a meditation practice or maybe it's for the entire journey. I'm still on it, so who knows. But I think a large part of meditation practice is just the ability to not run away from what you're experiencing. It's to develop the discipline to sit still and pay attention to what's happening. There's nothing particular you're trying to do, or nothing particular meditation's trying to do. It's just having the discipline to stop doing what you normally do and sit still and be quiet. Pay attention. So there is no good or bad meditation. There's just, wow. I'm still amazed, actually. We go on these meditation retreats where we sit for about 9 hours a day for several days on end. I'm still amazed that I can do that. Think, how in the world do I do that? It doesn't make any sense still, and that's great. I don't want it to make sense. But maybe that's all meditation practice is about. It's just learning to be still and be with what is for periods of time. And all that special stuff that we experience, the magical stuff in meditation, maybe that's happening all the time and has nothing to do with meditation at all. It's just what's happening. But meditation allows us to be still enough to realize it and to know it. And then to not know it. And just be life happening, yeah? So that's my story. And I'm not sticking to it. Nor is it sticking to me, but if it sticks to you at all, or if there's anything sticking to you now, we have time maybe to, you know, bring in anything you'd like to. Have some exploration and conversation together. Maybe we can call it story time. What are your stories? Yeah.
So, while I do train a lot of Vipassana, one thing that I think kind of goes along with one of the last things you were saying that I was just kind of curious about, when I mainly practice Vipassana and whatnot, we're always saying focus on the breath. What I tried changing was more or less just while focusing on the breath, but opening up just to overall experience while doing that. And while I know that that's a different tradition per se, or at least that's a story.
Yeah.
Is that, I guess I'm almost asking, is that correct? But is that along the same lines, or just opening up to treating it more like, okay, I don't know what's going to happen next, even though I'm sitting here, it would seem like the floor isn't going to give out underneath me or anything, but just being open to what is, kind of broadening that, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense at all.
Probably the specific approach is different, but one of the, in Zen, one of the initial things we'll offer is a meditation practice, not meaning this is what you do first and then we're going to give you something else later. As I see it, in Zen, we give you everything at the very beginning. That's a lifelong practice, and one of those is focusing on the breath. But it's not so much, for me, because it's, I always tell people, your meditation is your meditation. I can't get in there and see what you're doing and go, hey, no. So for me, it's more of a place to anchor so that the mind that wants to run everywhere doesn't do that as much. So it doesn't require me to really focus too much on the breath. It's just kind of gently hold on to the breath. Follow it. While the other stuff is still happening. And there can be the both happening at once thing, or there can be the, whoop, I went off on a train ride with that thought. And that's all. It's again, by focusing on the breath in this way, it gives me a chance to notice when I've lost focus on my breath, which doesn't mean anything other than, oh, you lost focus on your breath. And then from there, we introduce an awareness practice, is what I call it. And that's just opening up to the space. And sometimes it's helpful to do the breath focusing stuff, concentration practice, we call it, to get anchored. And then once you feel kind of settled, you drop that and you just open up to the space and allow what is to be there flowing in and out without any particular focus. And then we do the third of an inquiry practice, which is to be on the base level, just to be curious about your experience. What is this? Or just, huh? Joan Sutherland, that was just like the all-purpose koan is, huh? So to be curious about things, and so a formal inquiry is taking up koan practice. But at the base of it, as hopefully was coming through, is just to be curious and to be looking into things. And then after you do that for a while, and maybe this is your experience in the Vipassana traditions, then you find yourself doing it, or you find it doing itself in your life. Like today, when I was, for the first time in a long time, I was justified that I could have honked my horn at somebody. I mean, this person pulled right in front of me, had been over here, went behind me, pulled right in front of me, and I was like, huh, what are they doing? I should honk. Oh, they're too far now.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
But I was like, oh, if I ever wanted a reason to, that was it. I missed it. But I was more curious about, huh. But I probably, thankfully, he didn't hit me. But that was kind of like, huh. That's how your life gets warped when you take up a meditation practice. Does that answer, or is there anything
yes.
else?
Yeah, no, I wasn't even going to originally ask that, but I'm trying to even remember what it was. At the very end, I'm like, you know, that kind of almost gets upon that question, but thank you. Yes, it does.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Is the purpose of the Zen Buddhist to reach enlightenment and end the cycle of life?
You'd probably have to ask every Zen Buddhist to find out what the purpose is. The question was, is the purpose of Zen to reach enlightenment, then get off of the wheel of birth and death, you know, be completely liberated? Well, these questions that I brought in tonight, and I'll respond further than this to your question. I updated these questions, this little koan, because it came from a time and it was rooted in a culture that, you know, I was looking at these questions before. I was like, these aren't quite the questions we're asking today, but they're rooted in the tradition. It was somebody probably asking these very questions you're asking, not asking, but touching on those topics. The original version is, what is liberation? I thought it was interesting. Instead of saying, how do I get free? It's, what is liberation? It's kind of a different approach. But it's, you know, awakening, enlightenment. What is that? And so the response is, who has ever chained you? Yeah? That one was pretty much the same. And then the next one was, what is the pure land? So we're talking about pure land Buddhism, where there's a land where it's all purity. And that's the response was, who has ever defiled you? And the last one was, what is nirvana? So nirvana being that place of final release, being beyond it all. And the response was, who has ever kept you, or who, you know, kept you, limited you to the cycle of birth and death? So it may be an individual's goal to have those things, but in these responses he's saying, what are you talking about enlightenment? What are you talking about wheel of birth and death? You're not limited to them. You already are there. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways the practice is to help get rid of the notion of there's such a thing as enlightenment. Because when you give that up, what a relief. Some of the cadets brought in this week something that's always on my mind. Not always, obviously. But comes to my mind a lot when that kind of question comes up is, if I think there's an enlightenment here and I'm not there, it's that whole mathematical thing that we have these two points and you can cut them in half all the time. They will never meet mathematically. Those points will never meet because they are two established points. So I think in the practice it's about, don't establish two points. Maybe don't even establish one point. But I want to also bring in something that I think is, I found it to be important. It was when I read this, it was an interview with Bernie Glassman Roshi, who's a Zen teacher based out of New York, but he's in many places. And somebody asked a question along those lines, but it was more of, his response was what I really appreciated, because it goes beyond our individual, what do I want out of this? He said, what the goal of the practice might be, what Zen itself might want outside of our ideas, is to give us the experience of being connected to everything. To break down the divisions, the two points, and break all that down, to give us that experience directly. Because once you have that experience, it fundamentally changes the way you live your life. You can't live it the same way when you know intimately for yourself that experience. So, I don't know. Does that help at all?
Yes. Is a higher level of awareness, is that any way like enlightenment? Enlightenment be like a higher level of awareness?
Yes. In the same way that a lower level of awareness is just the same as the high, you know, it's all enlightenment, it's all awakening. Because if I say, oh yes, if you have a higher level of awareness, that's awakening, that sets you up to have a story that, well, I should be like that all the time. there's this thing, in what I was speaking of, when you're sitting down looking at those stories and stuff that you tell, that we all tell, and you become aware of them, and then you realize, oh, this one's outgrown its use. This one's actually useful, I can keep it, but just not to say, maybe it's a short story, not a novel. I can keep it to the short story, all that kind of stuff. It's really removing the barriers that keep us from experiencing our lives more fully. And so there might be an experience of when we have fewer of those barriers that are in our way and we're bumping up against, it might feel like there's more connection and awareness to things. But I'd say it's just a different quality of the awakening than what we already are. And that's when it gets into the weird Zen paradoxical, I'm not saying kind of stuff. But does that help enough?
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else out there floating among us?
Yes. I'd like to get back to the breathing.
All right.
I was taught a certain way to breathe, and I was taught that it's opposite of our normal breathing, the meditation breathing. Mm-hmm. So, without focusing on this whole process, how can those of you that do it all the time, how can you get to where you're at that way of breathing more often without having to actually stop and say, okay,
well,
I think we breathe shallowly, and that's what gets us into
it. I mean, that's when I teach people how to breathe at the begining, it's to breathe deeply into your abdomen. That's the relaxation breath. Instead of breathing up here, it's just to go and do stuff. But what I say is don't hold it tightly and make it a technique as much as just give it a channel to flow. And it also lets me notice when I'm not breathing there. Say, oh, here I am up here. But instead of being, I need to be breathing like that all the time, it's kind of a gateway to the experience of what it's like to breathe that way. And then I think it can take care of itself, actually, without me having to do that particular technique. So maybe, I think that's a thing, we learn these techniques in Zen and Buddhism that sometimes are presented or received as being, this is the technique to do, when it's really meant to be, this is a stepping stone, this is a gateway, to help you connect with what you already are. And then you don't have to worry about doing that technique so much like that, because your breath finds its natural place in the universe, yeah? I think that's one of the things that is happening with the whole mindfulness movement, craze, whatever you want to call it. It's like mindfulness, when you train in mindfulness, it's meant to, as I've experienced it, to become obsolete as a training, because then there's a mindfulness and an awareness, to go back to what you were bringing in, that's happening already, that the technique helped me connect with what's already happening. So then I don't need to use the technique, because I actually found it was limiting me, because I was beating myself up because I wasn't mindful for 5 seconds, or maybe 2 days. So I think all of the techniques, all of even the koan practices, I mean, that evolves over time, the way individuals take them up. And I think they're all meant to become obsolete. We use them until we wear them out, because then we don't need them to do anything for us. Then we just do it because we enjoy them. We're not trying to get anything out of them. Yeah?
Maybe just practice until it becomes a natural. Or not natural, but trying to say.
Well, yeah, just
without having to think about it, without having to get upset and say, okay, I better sit down and breathe for 5 minutes.
Probably when you notice the edge of you've outlived the use of it, but you're still trying to enforce it upon yourself, that's the thing to go, huh, maybe there's something happening that I don't need to be imposing anything upon anymore. Yeah? Imposing in a good way. That's the whole question, I think. Why do you take up a practice like this if you're inherently free already? And it's kind of like, well, you don't feel free. That's why. So we do these kind of out of the normal things to put us into a way of touching into it. And just by doing that, we can begin to touch into it without needing the things that got us there. Ugh, does that make sense? Yeah, another thing of that, if our freedom is contingent upon anything, if good meditation is contingent upon one single thing, then it's limited. If it's ever contingent or dependent upon anything, if we can wear out everything that brings us to the place we think we want to be and just be where we are, we might find, that might be all we find is,
yeah.